Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The transfer of power, an unprecedented security apparatus, is now in place in Washington as at least a dozen National Guard are removed from duty because of inappropriate comments or texts. Then, the Biden agenda. The Senate holds confirmation hearings for the Treasury Secretary and critical national security officials amid a time of instability. Plus, the Trump legacy. On the final day of this administration, we look back at the president and his impact. And rethinking college. The many disruptions and stressors brought on by the pandemic take a toll on college students' mental health.
Before COVID, students were already struggling with anxiety, depression, and loneliness, and that has only been exacerbated.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. We have three major stories tonight, how law enforcement and the military are working to secure a peaceful transfer of power on the eve of the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. The U.S. passes the grim milestone of 400,000 deaths from COVID-19. We'll see how those deaths are being recognized tonight in the nation's capital. And a marathon of confirmation hearings for President-elect Biden's incoming cabinet began today. Senators heard from five crucial nominees amid security concerns on the eve of the inauguration. The choice to head the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, vowed to prevent a repeat of the attack that gripped the U.S. Capitol.
If I should have the honor of being confirmed, I will do everything I can to ensure that the tragic loss of life, the assault on law enforcement, the desecration of the building that stands as one of the three pillars of our democracy, the terror that you felt, your colleagues, staff, and everyone present will not happen again.
Meantime, ensuring the security of an inauguration like no other continues on an unprecedented scale. Tens of thousands of National Guard members and security personnel have turned downtown Washington into a fortress less than 2 weeks after a mob of insurrectionists attacked the U.S. Capitol. And all of this amid a raging pandemic. Amna Nawaz has this report on how the Capitol complex is being made secure for the inauguration of the 46th President of the United States.
Beyond the flags and the bunting, the U.S. Capitol looks more fortress than festivities. A 7-foot metal fence surrounds Capitol Hill. The National Mall is closed to visitors. In and around the complex, National Guardsmen keep watch, all to avoid this.
It's over! You better run, cops!
Another January 6th, when thousands of rioters incited by President Trump breached police barricades and broke into the Capitol. The inauguration presents a high-profile opportunity for those seeking to do more harm.
And there are probably some out there who think that there is no bigger moment in American politics with more cameras turned on to commit an act of violence.
Heidi Byrick is the co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism. The Capitol assault, she says, brought together previously disparate groups like white supremacists, conspiracy theorists, and anti-government militants, all finding common cause in their support for the president. And the president spurred them to action, said Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people.
The nature of the threat that we face in the United States now with all these extreme right factions joining up together is we have a movement in the country that doesn't believe in the democratic system, doesn't believe in voting, and basically is against our form of government. And some of these folks are violent.
The FBI has so far fielded more than 140,000 tips, opened more than 200 suspect files, and arrested more than 100 people. FBI Director Chris Wray briefed Vice President Pence last week.
Right now, we're tracking calls for potential armed protests and activity leading up to the inauguration.
Get these people off the street. That's a great disruption strategy.
Former FBI Special Agent Tim Gallagher is now managing director at Kroll, a risk management firm. He led intelligence gathering for the 2009 inauguration of Barack Obama.
The difference between what happened on the 6th and the inauguration is that the inauguration is a national special security event, and this has been planned for several months. And because of that, there are many resources that are available to law enforcement and intelligence, which were not available on the 6th. The National Guard presence, the concentric rings of security, the checkpoints are being set up right now. They were set up an extra week in advance to not give bad actors an opportunity to pre-stage and to put their plans into place.
The U.S. Secret Service has essentially cut off access to downtown Washington, D.C., including the White House and the Capitol. And experts say all of these measures, the arrests, the troop presence, and the barriers, they will all help to deter inauguration threats here in Washington, D.C. But they also worry those same measures could push the threat to other places.
Bad actors will figure out where the event is going to take place, where the perimeters will be put up, and pre-staging weapons, whether that be pipes, bricks, hammers, you name it. Or if they put it right outside the perimeter, you know, to create a diversionary device where they could possibly draw out forces that should be on the perimeter.
Added to that is the new concern of a so-called insider attack by a member of the armed services after several were arrested following the Capitol attack. The FBI announced it's vetting each of the 25,000 National Guardsmen deployed for inauguration security. On Tuesday morning, two National Guard members were removed from the post, reportedly because of ties to right-wing extremist groups.
Let me be clear. Extremism is not tolerated in any branch of the United States military.
But Byrick says the Pentagon, like many institutions, has long failed to take seriously extremism in its ranks.
It's pretty late in the game to be figuring out if you've got a committed white supremacist who's already inside the security barriers.
Fears of Inauguration Day violence also have state capitals across the country on high alert. More than a dozen have activated their own National Guard. But the FBI's previous warning of potentially violent activity leading up to the inauguration has not borne out. A Sunday protest at the Michigan State House was attended by heavily armed members of the Boogaloo Boys, a right-wing extremist group, but remained peaceful. Here's one of their members, 22-year-old Timothy Teagan.
The 6th changed everything for us. It made us really worried about coming out here. I've heard the FBI stopped by my work 3 days ago to talk to me about coming out here.
Byrick says online chatter shows many of these groups are now hesitant to mobilize for Inauguration Day with the same force they did on January 6th.
On the one hand, it's a positive that lots and lots of these groups are probably not going to show up on January 20th. And yet the big threat, just like it was in Pittsburgh at the Tree of Life Synagogue or the El Paso Walmart, is a lone shooter. But the problem here is that we have a lot of radicalized people in the United States because of years and years of being exposed to these ideas. The threat is not going to go away just because we're having a change in administration.
For Gallagher, who 20 years ago was on the FBI team responding to the Flight 93 crash site, today's threat is hard to process.
The individuals on that plane took down that plane to save the U.S. Capitol. Fast forward 20 years, we have U.S. citizens, Americans, attacking that very capital that was saved by those individuals who sacrificed their lives on 9/11.
The Biden-Harris team has been getting regular briefings on Inauguration Day threats and, despite concerns, are committed to maintaining much of the tradition. In a video message, Harris urged supporters to savor the ceremony.
So I know this Inauguration Day may look a little different from years past, a lot different, but let's all take a moment to celebrate, and then let's get to work building the America we know is possible.
Those two National Guard troops who were relieved of their inauguration-related duties have been sent home from here in Washington, D.C., and officials say they were removed because of inappropriate text and comments. One of those had been flagged within the chain of command, another by an anonymous tip. On top of that, our colleague Nick Schifrin has confirmed that 10 additional National Guard troops have also been removed from their inauguration-related duties. Not, officials say, because of any inauguration-specific threat, but rather, they say, because of other reasons, suggesting perhaps the FBI vetting process revealed some kind of concerns. Judy, all of this, though, shows just how seriously they're taking security here and how security officials are not willing to take any chance on the eve of the historic inauguration tomorrow. Judy?
Certainly very different from January the 6th. Amna Nawaz, thank you, and you'll be reporting tomorrow for us on the Mall in Washington. Thank you. So all of these preparations come as, we've been saying, President-elect Biden prepares to focus on other major crises, the COVID pandemic that has claimed 400,000 lives in this country and continues to inflict major damage to the economy. Those concerns were the primary focus of a separate confirmation hearing today, this one for Janet Yellen, Mr. Biden's choice for Treasury Secretary. The former chair of the Federal Reserve told some skeptical Republican senators why she believes it's important to act now and pass a $1.9 trillion economic package.
We're going to need more aid to distribute the vaccine, to reopen schools, to help states keep firefighters and teachers on the job. With interest rates at historic lows, the smartest thing we can do is act big. In the long run, I believe the benefits will far outweigh the costs, especially if we care about helping people who've been struggling for a very long time.
Meantime, the top three national security officials nominated by President-elect Biden had their hearings today, too. For this, I want to bring in our Nick Schifrin. Lloyd Austin, Nick, is the Secretary of Defense designate. First of all, tell us how fears of extremism that we heard Amna reporting on just a moment ago, extremism in the military, come up during his Senate session.
Yeah, Judy, Lloyd Austin addressed that right at the top of his opening statement. Remember that Austin would be the first Black Secretary of Defense. He was the first Black officer to command a division in combat and a theater of war. And today he said he would fight not only right-wing extremism, but also discrimination.
We also owe our people a working environment free of discrimination, hate, and harassment. And if confirmed, I will fight hard to stamp out sexual assault and to rid our ranks of racist and extremist and to create a climate where everyone fit and willing has the opportunity to serve this country with dignity. The job of the Department of Defense is to keep America safe from our enemies. But we can't do that if some of those enemies lie within our own ranks.
Austin told the story of when he was a lieutenant colonel, his unit found somebody that was an extremist, and he said that the signs were there all along. We just didn't know what to look at. He said, Judy, today that he would apply the lessons he learned at that point to today.
And Nick, we know Lloyd Austin was a four-star general until he retired in 2016. He would need a waiver in order to serve as a civilian Secretary of Defense. How did he address that today?
Yeah, Judy, as you know, Democrats in both the House and the Senate opposed the last waiver to retired General James Mattis. And to assuage those fears, Austin today said that he would work hand in glove with the State Department and also appoint civilians to senior roles and empower them to make decisions.
The safety and security of our democracy demands competent civilian control of our armed forces, the subordination of military power to the civil. I intend to surround myself with and empower experienced, capable civilian leaders who will enable healthy civil-military relations grounded in meaningful oversight. And so I think the people in the room when contributing to the decision-making, it makes all a difference in the world.
And many Democrats who voted against the last waiver, Judy, have already indicated that they will vote for this waiver in both the House and the Senate.
And Nick, another important confirmation hearing today for high national security official is for Avril Haines, nominated to be Director of National Intelligence. Tell us how that came down.
Yeah, Haines emphasized an almost centrist, traditional approach to intelligence, as evidenced by who she had introduce her, the former director of national intelligence and former Republican Senator Dan Coats. Haines is a lawyer. She's a former senior official in the Obama administration. And she said that intelligence had been politicized under the Trump administration, and she'd turn that around.
that we provide objective analysis, that we don't let politics play a role in our work is critical. And it has been my experience that that is what the institution is designed to do and intended to do. And it's fundamental to good policy decision making, because if policy makers like yourself and others throughout the government don't have that unvarnished analysis, they don't have sufficient information, they don't have the best information that we can provide them in order for them to make the decisions that they need to make in order to protect the country and pursue our interests.
Haynes said while it wasn't the intelligence community's primary job, she would assist the FBI and the DHS in assessing the threat posed by QAnon.
And Nick, a third important hearing today, and this one for the nominee to be Secretary of State, Tony Blinken. Tell us what was emphasized there.
Yeah, Blinken emphasized rebuilding alliances, as he put it, and he's channeling his boss there. Blinken has been with Biden for decades in the Senate and White House before Blinken became the Deputy Secretary of State. And today he reiterated their plan to re-enter the Iran nuclear deal so long as Iran follows through on its promises to reverse recent nuclear decisions.
The president-elect believes that if Iran comes back into compliance, we would too. But we would use that as a platform with our allies and partners, who would once again be on the same side with us, to seek a longer and stronger agreement, and also, as you and the chairman have rightly pointed out, to capture these other issues, particularly with regard to missiles and Iran's destabilizing activities.
Experts tell me that's going to be extremely difficult, Judy. On other topics, he actually praised the Trump administration, especially the principle of confronting Beijing, as he reiterated with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham.
Secretary Pompeo designated the Chinese Communist Party as having engaged in genocide regarding the Uyghur Muslim population. Do you agree with that designation?
That would be my judgment as well.
You do agree?
Yes.
Yeah, that's we're on a good start here. So I just very much appreciate that. Do you believe that the Chinese Communist Party misled the world about the coronavirus?
I do.
What price, if any, should they pay?
They did not give access when it mattered most in the early days of this virus. Had they done so, it's possible that the course of the virus would have been different and we could have dealt with it sooner and more effectively. My sense, Senator, going forward, is that what we should be focusing on, I know people talk about the punitive, I would be very focused on the preventative.
On that first topic, the State Department today designated that Beijing had committed genocide and crimes against humanity against the Uyghurs, that is, a Muslim minority in Western China. And earlier today, I got to talk to current State Department Ambassador at Large for Global Issues, Kelly Curry. I started by asking her whether the State Department could prove Beijing's actions constituted genocide, but also the legally required intent to destroy the Uyghurs.
We've seen what they do when they're trying to destroy a group. And this is something a little bit different because it does not involve the kind of mass killings that you would see in, say, Rwanda or Srebrenica. This is true. But we are seeing an intention to destroy a group. We've seen the Chinese Communist Party's officials talk about the Uyghurs and these other groups as tumors, malignant tumors that have to be removed, to make statements about how you can't just pluck all the weeds from the field one by one. You have to use chemicals to kill them all when talking about Uyghurs within the Chinese state. And so the language from the Chinese Communist Party's leadership has been pretty explicit on some of these fronts. When you put that together with the acts that they have committed, specifically the forced sterilization, the forced abortion, the forced birth control of Uyghur women, and the efforts, the systematic efforts that they have taken to ensure compliance with these coercive population control measures that have been in place for the past 3 years, then the secretary came to the conclusion that genocide was the appropriate designation.
What do you believe are the practical implications of using these terms, genocide, crimes against humanity, after, as you said, there's been so much documentation of what's been happening in Xinjiang?
Well, while there is tremendous documentation, and most of it is in open source material, but what we have not seen is what we believe is the appropriate response on the part of the international community. The United States has leveled sanctions against perpetrators in this context. We've sanctioned individual Communist Party members. We have sanctioned entities such as the Xinjiang Production and Construction Corporation, which we believe support the architecture of repression in Xinjiang. And we've also taken action such as the recent withhold release order, which essentially bans the import of cotton and tomato products into the United States that originate in Xinjiang. And we believe that by making these determinations, and the Secretary believes that by making these determinations, we can help to get the world's attention and get them to respond in similar ways to what we have done here in the United States.
Why today, of all days, if the goal is to galvanize international community, as you just pointed out, aren't you worried that making this announcement literally 24 hours before inauguration could lead some people to say this is more about politics than policy?
We have really worked hard to keep these decisions above politics and outside of politics by focusing on the facts and on the information. Unfortunately, these are lengthy and exhaustive processes, and we've been able to complete them in relatively recent days and tee up decisions for the Secretary. And believe me, if we could have made these decisions sooner, we would have. I think that we also believe that this is an issue that has strong bipartisan support. And so we believe that this is an issue that will continue to resonate and should resonate outside of politics.
Do you believe that by doing this the day before inauguration, you are boxing the Biden administration in or helping them galvanize international opinion?
Well, it's up to the Biden administration how they take this determination and what they do with it.
And as the State Department concluded that today's designation imposes any legal requirements on the U.S. government moving forward?
Again, these are not legal decisions. Last week, if the Department of Homeland Security wanted to exclude someone that they believed was guilty of genocide, they had the legal authority to do that, whether it was in this context or any other. The same with the Department of Justice. If they wanted to bring up charges under U.S. statutes, they're able to do that. What this does do is give us an additional tool to use in the implementation of our foreign policy objectives and the ability to advance those objectives, particularly with our partners around the world who we continue to work with to try to build out the coalition of countries that have recognized the gravity of the situation in Xinjiang and are moving to act.
Ambassador Curry, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick.
In the day's other news, the U.S. reached 400,000 deaths from COVID-19, nearly equal to the number of Americans killed in World War II. 100,000 of those occurred just in the past month. Meanwhile, a panel commissioned by the World Health Organization criticized the agency for not declaring a global emergency sooner. One panel member, former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, said that the WHO needs more enforcement power.
Member states are looking at WHO for leadership, coordination, and guidance, but are not equipping it with the authority, the access, or the funding needed to provide that.
The panel also criticized China and other nations for failing to act earlier on the pandemic. President-elect Biden had an emotional departure from his home state of Delaware today on the eve of his inauguration. It happened at a National Guard headquarters named for his elder son, Beau, who died of brain cancer in 2015. Mr. Biden noted the significance and then choked up.
General Biden, it's deeply personal that our next journey to Washington starts here, a place that defines the very best of who we are as Americans. Well, excuse the emotion, but when I die, Delaware will be written on my heart.
Later, the Bidens arrived at Joint Base Andrews outside Washington. They'll spend the night at Blair House, the president's official guest residence, before moving into the White House tomorrow. Mr. Biden will offer a sweeping immigration bill right after being sworn in. It's expected to provide an 8-year path to citizenship for some 11 million people living in the U.S. illegally. The nominee for Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, said today that the plan would fix a broken system. The incoming Senate Majority Leader says that an impeachment trial of President Trump will be a priority once Democrats take control tomorrow. By then, Mr. Trump will be out of office. And Senator Chuck Schumer confirmed today that he wants to keep it that way.
There will be an impeachment trial in the United States Senate. There will be a vote on convicting the president for high crimes and misdemeanors. And if the president is convicted, there will be a vote on barring him from running again.
Before a trial can begin, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has to send over the impeachment article passed by the House, charging Mr. Trump with inciting an insurrection. She has not said yet when that will happen. A federal appeals court today struck down President Trump's rollback of emissions curbs for coal-fired power plants. The curbs were imposed under the Obama administration, but the 3-judge panel found the Trump move was a fundamental misreading of the law. And on Wall Street, stocks rose on hopes for new economic stimulus in a Biden administration. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 116 points to close at 30,930. The Nasdaq rose 198 points, and the S&P 500 added 30. Still to come on the NewsHour on this final day, we examine the lasting legacy of the Trump presidency. The hundreds of thousands of Americans lost to COVID-19 are memorialized on the National Mall. And mental health struggles among college students rise dramatically amid the ongoing pandemic.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
While Congress looked ahead today toward governing under a President Biden, talk of pardons was a prominent part of this final day for the Trump administration. Our Yamiche Alcindor and Lisa Desjardins join me now. So hello to both of you. And to you first, Yamiche, we know traditionally presidents go out of office with a lot of conversation about pardons and commutation. And there's been speculation about what President Trump may do. What are you learning about that?
Well, Washington and really the nation sits on edge, waiting to see what was expected to be a long list of people pardoned by President Trump. And now I've been talking to White House officials all day. They tell me that they do not believe President Trump is going to pardon himself or members of his family, but he is looking at an array of people, including Steve Bannon, who was, of course, a former top White House official and someone who helped President Trump win in 2016, as well as Sheldon Silver, a disgraced New York assemblyman, and even rapper Lil Wayne, who was convicted of a gun charge. Another thing to note is that the president, experts say, has really broken with tradition when it comes to pardons. He has not gone through the traditional process of going through the Department of Justice to vet pardons often. They also say that he's been a president more than other presidents who has leaned in on pardoning people who are close to him or who serve some sort of political messaging. So he's pardoned Border Patrol agents who were convicted of unjustifiably shooting undocumented immigrants. He's also pardoned Charles Kushner, the father of Jared Kushner, his son-in-law. Another thing, the president could also issue pardons that aren't revealed. Experts call them, in some ways, secret pardons. These pardons, because the Constitution says that you don't have to, the president doesn't have to reveal who he's pardoned. There's some feeling, some worry that the president could pardon himself and we wouldn't know. Legal experts aren't sure whether or not the Biden administration would be able to see if that pardon was actually issued. Now, there is no indication that the president is going to issue some sort of pardon like that, but it is something to watch as we await this pardon list.
And Yamiche, we know the president is not going to be attending the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden tomorrow, but he is planning his own celebration as he leaves office. Tell us about that.
That's right. President Trump is leaving office, much like he started office, and that's steeped in controversy and breaking traditions. Here, the president is going to be the first president since 1869 not to go to his successor's swearing-in. The last president to do so was Andrew Johnson, who skipped Ulysses S. Grant's inauguration. Now, the president is said that he's going to have a sort of own departure party at Joint Base Andrews. There's talk of there possibly being a 21-gun salute, a color guard, a red carpet, all sorts of pomp and circumstance. One person that won't be there, even though there are a lot of people invited, including people who have criticized the president, Vice President Pence, he is office confirmed tonight that he is going to the inauguration of President-elect Biden and not going to President Trump's party. That is in some ways a window into the last days here of the Trump presidency, where Pence has had to do things like talk about the coronavirus and visit troops while President Trump has not taken questions or been seen in public in days. One other thing, Trump leaves office, President Trump leaves office with his legacy really, really tarnished. The president in the last few days, he has not apologized or said anything about the Capitol Hill siege. So there are a lot of people who are also angry at the president leaving the office like this.
And finally, to you, Lisa, we know the Senate tomorrow is going to change hands, as we're reporting. The Democrats will be in the majority. They've got a lot on their plate. One of the big items, of course, right away is impeachment. What do we know about how that's going to work?
Well, there are many decisions to be made. First, whether impeachment will happen simultaneously with, before, or after confirmation of many of the Biden appointees. There is a chance that some cabinet officials could be confirmed as soon as tomorrow in the Senate, but that would take unanimous consent, and we don't expect that. Judy, tonight, the leaders of the Republican and Democratic Party in the Senate, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, have been meeting to try and figure out a power-sharing deal, because tomorrow, starting then, the Senate will be 50-50 with the Democrats in charge only because of Vice President-elect Harris once she's inaugurated. So the truth is, Judy, a lot of this still has to be worked out.
Fascinating. So a lot of change going on all at the same time. Lisa Desjardins, Yamiche Alcindor, thank you both. As the sun sets on President Trump's final full day in office, a new PBS NewsHour NPR Marist poll shows that he leaves with just 38% of Americans approving of his presidency, while 57% disapprove of his job performance, nearly a record. Even today, President Trump remains defiant. In his pre-recorded farewell address, he touted the successes of his presidency and deplored the attack on the Capitol 2 weeks ago.
All Americans were horrified by the assault on our Capitol. Political violence is an attack on everything we cherish as Americans. It can never be tolerated. Now more than ever, we must unify around our shared values and rise above the partisan rancor and forge our common destiny. Now, as I prepare to hand power over to a new administration at noon on Wednesday, I want you to know that the movement we started is only just beginning. There's never been anything like it. The belief that a nation must serve its citizens will not dwindle, but instead only grow stronger by the day.
For a bigger look at Mr. Trump's 4 years in the White House, we turn to Peter Wehner. He's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington and a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. He also served in the last three Republican administrations, President Reagan and both Presidents Bush. Pete Wehner, thank you very much for being with us and for joining us again on the NewsHour. We're hearing President Trump go out of office saying it's been a big success, deploring what happened at the Capitol 2 weeks ago. What is the legacy he's leaving?
Well, thanks for having me on, Judy. I think the legacy is carnage and death and a lot of ruin. It hasn't been a success. I think it's been almost across the board a failure. I think that he's probably earned the appellation of the worst president in our history. And I must say, to hear him condemn political violence after he incited political violence on January 6th and unleashed an insurrectionist mob on the Capitol, I think that is, that breached a line that no president has ever breached before. And I think it's going to leave a searing impression on the moral imagination of the public. And I think it was a kind of capstone to the Trump presidency. There was almost an inevitability to it ending this way or something like this.
In fact, you wrote a column almost exactly 4 years ago today, wherein, among other things, you said he's unlikely to be contained by norms and customs or even by laws and the Constitution. How did that bear itself out?
Oh, I think it bore itself out almost every day in some way. It certainly bore itself out in the impeachment. He was a lawless president. And he violated norms in every single direction, civic and political. There was a savagery to our politics because of him. He was a battering ram against reality and against our institutions. And he's left our nation riven, basically broken up into warring political tribes. And I will say that, when I wrote that, it was one of the easier things to see. He was a person who was so easy to read. This was a person with sociopathic tendencies. And I just think a lot of people, particularly people in the Republican Party, which I've been a part of my entire political life, and as you said, I served in three Republican administrations, but the degree to which Republicans were blind to him and to his maliciousness and his malignancy, either willfully blind or simply blind, I think it's going to leave a crimson stain on the party. Certainly there's a crimson stain on the Trump legacy.
You are very much, Pete Wehner, a conservative. You were telling us today you agree with many of his appointments to the federal courts, economic policy, some of his foreign policy. You're giving him credit for some of the policy and the changes he made in policy and the law.
Yeah, in some areas. I don't think his record is anything like his supporters insist on, but I would say that his judicial appointments, I am a conservative judicial philosophy, and I think the Federalist Society basically chose his appointments, both at the Supreme Court level and the federal levels, and I think they were really good. And people I trust in the business world felt like his deregulation policies were successful. I agreed with him when he moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And there was some progress in the Middle East as it relates to Israel and Arab countries. Israel was recognized. I would say, Operation Warp Speed in terms of the vaccinations. Obviously, wasn't Trump himself, but Francis Collins is one of the brilliant medical and scientific minds in the world and a wonderful human being. NIH oversaw that along with these pharmaceutical companies. There's some success there. I will say on that last point, though, it's just overwhelmed by the mishandling, the epic mishandling by Trump and his administration in every other area on the pandemic. As you reported earlier, 400,000 deaths by the end of February, probably 500,000. Maybe half of those deaths were unnecessary because of the way that Trump handled it. That is an extraordinary human carnage, and it didn't have to be this way.
And interesting you should use the word carnage, because President Trump in his inaugural address spoke of American carnage, how he viewed the country as he was preparing to take over as president. What do you think he will be most remembered for? Do you think it's the pandemic and, in the final days, this attack on the U.S. Capitol?
I think so. I mean, I think the Capitol will be the single incident that people remember, because, as I said earlier, it was a kind of capstone to his presidency. There was nothing unexpected about that. And he was a person who, after all, egged them on, incited them, I think. I think just in terms of a single policy, it would have to be the pandemic. No president could have escaped unscathed. No country could have escaped unscathed because of this pandemic. Every country has lost lives. But again, I think he just so epically mishandled it with so many ways, attacking his scientists, the attacks on masks and social distancing, the hydroxychloroquine insanity. I think beyond that, Judy, I just wanted to say one other thing. And this, I think, is something that's going to be with us for a long, long time. And that is that we're in a kind of epistemic crisis, by which I mean that there has been an assault on truth and reality that Trump has led, and his party was a part of, and his base was a part of. And we now live in a world in which we just don't have policy difference. People are living in different moral universes, different epistemological universes. We don't have a common set of facts, even a common reality. And when you lose that, it's very, very difficult to put it back together again. But if you don't put it back together again, a free country can't continue. Ultimately, your politics breaks down and your society breaks down because there's no common ground, no ability to persuade other people, no ability to have dialogue. Trump did that with his conspiracy theories. So it wasn't just the lies. It was this intentional assault on reality, which not only spreads lies, but creates a kind of disorientation in the public that has tremendously damaging and long-term effects. And I worry about that. And that's, you know, Joe Biden's got a lot of tasks before him, but trying to figure out how to put that back together or help put that back together seems to me to be high on the list.
Pete Wehner, looking back and looking ahead. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me, Judy.
The day's events in the nation's capital concluded with a special ceremony today to recognize the human toll of the pandemic. A short time ago, President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris spoke at a tribute on the National Mall to remember the 400,000 lives already lost in the pandemic. It featured music, remarks, and 400 lights placed around the reflecting pool at the Lincoln Memorial. The event began with an invocation from the Archbishop of Washington, Cardinal Wilton Gregory.
At this twilight hour, our beloved nation reverently pauses in supplication to remember and to pray for the many thousands of people who have died from the coronavirus during this past year. We pray for those who have died and the families and loved ones that they left behind. And may it be a resounding gesture of gratitude for all those who have cared for the victims of this virus and their loved ones. Our sorrow unites us to one another as a single people with compassionate hearts.
Though we may be physically separated, we, the American people, are united in spirit. And my abiding hope, my abiding prayer, is that we emerge from this ordeal with a new wisdom to cherish simple moments, to imagine new possibilities, and to open our hearts just a little bit more to one another. It is now my great honor to introduce Lori Marie Key. Lori is a nurse at St. Mary Mercy Livonia Hospital outside of Detroit. Her community was hit hard when the virus struck, and Lori was assigned to the COVID unit. Lori is known for singing on the hospital floor, and a video of her singing a certain hymn inspired our nation. She joins us this evening to honor those we have lost with that same hymn, Amazing Grace.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see.
To heal, we must remember. It's hard sometimes to remember, but that's how we heal. It's important to do that as a nation. That's why we're here today. Between sundown and dusk, let us shine the lights
in the darkness along the sacred pool of reflection, remember all whom we lost.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall and the major lift. The baffled king composing, hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
What a beautiful sight. What beautiful music at such a painful moment. Finally tonight, we look at how the pandemic is affecting the mental health of college students. Students have long been prone to stress, anxiety, and depression. According to the CDC, 3 out of 4 Americans between the ages of 18 and 24 report poor mental health tied to the pandemic. Hari Srinivasan has our story. It's part of our ongoing series, Rethinking College, and a warning for some viewers. This story deals with the subject of suicide.
The nights leading up to it had shown that like there was going to be some sort of culmination. And that night, I was kind of worried that I was going to do something that I might regret.
19-year-old Victoria Canales was alone the night she almost gave up everything. Alone in a 3-bedroom apartment in Austin near the University of Texas campus. No friends. Her roommate stayed home fall semester. No family. They were hundreds of miles away in Laredo. Panic led her to stop taking her antidepressant medication, and her good grades were slipping away too. Unsure where else to turn, Canales dialed her school's crisis hotline.
I told them, like, I'm feeling pretty bad. I'm not doing too well in my classes. I'd kind of just like somebody to talk to.
They kept her on the phone for an hour and a half.
And then by the end of it, she told me, you know, I would like to be able to hang up and know that everything's going to be okay, but based on kind of what we were talking about tonight, I think I'd like to send the campus mental health officers over just to go check and make sure that everything is okay.
They sent someone over, and Canales decided in that moment to make some changes because she was not okay. Many students are not right now. Drop a pin on a map of the U.S. and the story is much the same. Heightened isolation, depression, anxiety, mental health crises, courtesy of a college experience stripped almost entirely of campus life, tradition, and structure, on top of a pandemic.
College seems like a really far away concept right now.
No matter who you are, it really sucks.
It's really messed with my head and ways I never thought possible.
It's hard to sleep at night because you just sit in your apartment all day.
I think almost all of my friends have started going to therapy since this semester started.
More than 560,000 undergraduate students did not enroll this fall compared to 2019. Even in normal times, those who report mental health struggles are nearly twice as likely to drop out of school than their peers. There are stressors for those studying remotely.
It's very exhausting. Definitely Zoom fatigue is real.
And for those making the trek into classrooms.
Since I commute a lot, I try to be as careful as possible, especially knowing that a few of the people that I know that has gotten the virus have been really, really sick. They were very near to death.
1 in 4 Americans between the ages of 18 and 24 reported having seriously considered suicide in the last 30 days, according to the CDC. And nearly 70% of college presidents now say student mental health ranks among their top concerns.
I think for a lot of us, it's just been sort of feeling like a bit of a loss of that experience.
Yeah, been an incredible challenge.
Varun Soni is the Vice Provost for Campus Wellness and Crisis Intervention at the University of Southern California.
Before COVID, students were already struggling with anxiety, depression, and loneliness, and that has only been exacerbated.
In fact, Sony says before the pandemic, 65% of college students were wrestling with anxiety, 30% with a mental health condition, and 10% with thoughts of suicide. Sony says the string of recent American crises, combined with an over-reliance on technology and social media, are making today's young people more anxious than ever before. And COVID isolation has made it worse.
We're tribal people as human beings. We need a tribe. And college is a place where many students find their tribe. And so I think for a number of students, 80% of students around the country say that COVID has negatively impacted their mental health, their spiritual health, and their career aspirations.
Young people like Jasmine Guerrero, a junior at California State University at Northridge, say the main problem is students feel like they're in all of this alone, emotionally and academically.
It's been rough this semester.
I don't even feel like I'm learning crap.
Yeah. We attend campus to learn and to network, and we're just getting learning. I know a lot of people that say, hey, you know, I'm just turning in assignments without even knowing if the information is staying in with me, you know?
I met up with Dr. Mickey Sharma on Ohio State University's famous Oval, usually packed with students, now largely deserted. Here, at one of the biggest schools in the nation, student plans have been altered by the tens of thousands. They won't get those experiences back. Sharma directs OSU's Student Life Counseling and Consultation Service.
How do you help them get over the fact that they had plans? The plans changed.
The first thing we do is validate the student's feelings is real. What you're talking about is loss. I would say to the student, instead of focusing on things being normal again, what I want you to focus on is creating your new normal. We can proactively be a part of what we want the future to be.
Did you meet your goals? How do you feel after this full semester online?
Most schools offer mental health and academic counseling for students, but virtual and in-person visits against expectations have been either flat or down for many schools. And that's another sign of trouble, says Varun Soni at USC.
So I think all universities are concerned about what's happening in home environments, in remote environments, abroad, because we're not as connected as we used to be. I think what all of my colleagues around the country are wrestling with is, what are we not seeing?
This is my first mariachi gig.
Victoria Canales says spring semester at the University of Texas could be a repeat of fall. Not much has changed about her situation.
So I've been seeing my therapist, and it's been a really good experience. I also got back on my antidepressants.
She also plans to take fewer classes and find more time for fun.
I do want to spend more time kind of like on the things that I enjoy. I love music. I love playing instruments. Hopefully next semester I'm just going to try and push myself to do the things that I know I will enjoy. I don't know. We'll see.
She'll take it a little easier on herself and take the days one at a time until things get back to normal. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Hari Srinivasan.
If you or someone you know needs help, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24 hours a day. Write this down. Call 1-800-273-8255. In the final installment of Hari's series next week, we'll look at how schools are providing special programs to boost skills and allow students to get short-term credentials for work. One other important note from the world of higher education, the College Board announced today that it will drop the optional essay part of the SATs and end SAT subject matter tests altogether. Both changes will take effect in June. And finally, on an uplifting note, we want to take a moment to wish a happy birthday to one of our NewsHour founding fathers. Robin McNeil turns 90 years young today. Happy birthday, Robin. We love you. And that's a NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us tomorrow starting at 10:30 a.m. Eastern for special live coverage of the inauguration of the next president and vice president, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you then.